Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. John Krosnick, the director of Stanford University's Political Psychology Program. He's also the Frederick O. Glover Professor in Humanities and Social Sciences at Stanford. Dr. Krosnick received the Eric Erickson Award for Excellence in Creativity in the Field of Political Psychology from the International Society of Political Psychology. And also joining us is Pepper Schwartz, a professor of sociology and sexology at the University of Washington in Seattle. She has been profiled by the New York Times, People, Seattle Magazine, Metropolitan Magazine, Time, Newsweek, and Law and Politics Magazine. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. John Krosnick and Pepper Schwartz.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Thank you.
And Dr. Krosnick, let me begin with you. I guess the question of the moment here is, given Anthony Weiner's problems and also the mayor of San Diego, Bob Filner's problems, that I'm trying to understand the psychological underpinning of politicians whose risky behavior exposes them to scandal and their wives to humiliation. I can just, you know, if you need them to be reminded, I can throw a few names out there as well as Anthony Weiner. You've got Bill Clinton, Newt Gingrich, David Vinter, and Mark Stanford, all of them who, of course, were redeemed. I'm not sure that Weiner will be. So what is it about these politicians?
Well, it's, you know, certainly the situation that politicians find themselves in is one where they often exist in a bubble. One of my favorite stories comes from the George W. Bush presidency, when at one point Mrs. Bush was asked about how the president felt about his low approval rating in the country toward the end of his presidency. And Mrs. Bush said, you know, I don't see how these polls can be right, because everybody we talk to loves the job that he's doing. And I think that's an indication of the kind of bubble that politicians understandably get into that may give them a sense of invulnerability. And you mentioned Bill Clinton. I think the Clinton experience is a particularly important one because, as I think many people remember, even though when the Monica Lewinsky scandal was revealed, ratings of Clinton as a person declined in the country, but his approval rating as president did not decline one drop. And so there was a sense in which Americans said, you know, I may not want to have a beer with the guy anymore, but he's doing a good job as president. The country, the economy is doing well. We're doing it well internationally. And so people can see the difference between those. And you can imagine that that also might give politicians a sense of invulnerability if they feel they're professionally competent.
And Pepper Schwartz, the list of names that I just read, all of whom have had had their road to Damascus experience and come back, I'm not sure that Weiner will. I must say that what I was struck by most of all was the humiliation that the poor wife was going through. And I remember that also from Vitter's wife. And I remember that also from the New Jersey, I think it was a governor who turned out to be gay, and his wife really was deeply embarrassed. So tell me about the wives of these men. Why do they stand by them?
Well, a lot of them have this I'm with a great man syndrome, and I have to suffer for that. And I want to protect my relationship, even though he done me wrong. And even though I am a woman of my own stature, as in Hillary or Yuma, Hama, I guess it's pronounced, that's nothing compared to him. So they sort of buy into his narcissism, which is, you know, I should be allowed to do what I do. Yes, these are picadillos. Yes, they have humiliated you. But I deserve to be president, or I deserve to be mayor, and they buy into that. And that's complicated, of course, by their what they think of marriage and having children, and what that would do to, you know, their values about that. But I think this sort of reflected glory and willing to suffer for your man kind of thing is still very female. And while they struggle to keep their dignity in terms of what they say and how they stand there, you can see it's excruciating. And what is interesting is that their husbands are willing to put them through it, and they are willing to go along.
And Dr. John Krosnick, is this something unique about the Anglo-Saxons? Because I used to work for the BBC, and I can remember some really bizarre scandals involving sex with all kinds of sexes and with politicians at the highest council in government. And if you contrast the names and the list that I just read a little while ago, and the current situation with Wiener and Filner in San Diego. Compare that, for example, to the French. You know, the famously Mitterrand's funeral, his wife attended along with the mistress, and also their illegitimate daughter showed up as well. So, is this uniquely Anglo-Saxon, to this tortured relationship between sex and politics?
Well, you can certainly. The French is an example that comes immediately to mind. Of course, as you say, where you know, there are a different set of standards. And, you know, that's a case where, you know, you might imagine that individuals who have been essentially feeling to be family members of his over time would feel entitled to come to his funeral. That's, you know, obviously a different question from whether the society forgives this kind of behavior in its leaders. And the truth is, we have seen evidence in a number of other countries where citizens say, okay, what's the problem? This is his or her private life. This is not something that we need to be passing judgment on if he or she is doing a good job for the country. And so it raises a very interesting question about America, that we have a set of collective values that suggest that this behavior is abhorrent. And so when the press latch on to something like this, make an issue of it, you know, it's everybody sort of knows the script, which is this is a behavior to be condemned. But the important question, I think, at that point is, you know, are Americans eventually going to come around to say, well, you know, maybe it's better to have somebody competent running the country, regardless of what I think about their private life. In other words, asking, I will decide whether to vote for this person for president or not based upon whether I'd like to have a beer with him or her, is a pretty interesting strategy, given that the likelihood of any of us having a beer with that person is pretty low.
And Pepper Schwartz, what's your take on this peculiar mixture here in the United States between piety, pornography, and politicians and piety? I mean, obviously we have a lot of value voters on the Christian right, but then, of course, you've had an equal number of scandals of many of their luminaries falling from grace. So how much are we unique in our religiosity in politics?
We are fairly unique. We are an extremely religious country. One might argue that in the top 1% of religious countries. And we do, in fact, have a high level of being hypocrites. I mean, we don't do what we value, but we stick up for our values anyhow. However, I would like to make an exception in the sense, I think, you have Governor Sanford, who, you know, his wife divorced him, he married his true love, and I think people go, okay. But the level of compulsivity, the idea that something's wrong with this guy, is different than just having, you know, a personal relationship with another woman. Moreover, the level of obsessiveness in that after he was humiliated, caught, and had to leave his job and enter treatment and do the whole, you know, tail between your legs public deal, he continued to do the same behavior.
And, of course, you're referring to Anthony Weiner, the person of the moment, right?
Yes. Well, but, I mean, I think the difference is the public looking at a man like Weiner, who's compulsive, who simply cannot control his behavior, versus somebody who has an affair. The affair looks like motherhood and apple pie next to this.
Right. Well, but isn't there, I mean, at the risk of sounding like a pop psychologist, isn't it pretty clear that there's a full measure of narcissism here? The pictures he takes of his buffed body and all, not to mention his crotch, but his buffed body. I mean, doesn't that scream out at you?
Oh, yes. I mean, it is narcissistic, and he is narcissistic in just about any way you want to check the boxes. But the fact is, there's a popular saying among Americans these days called TMI, too much information. If you drag us into your life, and indeed, if you drag unsuspecting women out there with anonymous identities and create a loop with them that they're really unaware of who they're dealing with, you take it out of the sort of private zone where we'd love it to stay, and you then make us have to be party to this, which we really don't want to be.
And Dr. John Krasnick, again, the director of the Stanford University Political Psychology Program, do you see any in your research, any thread here in terms of risky behavior and that being a kind of psychological defect of those that enter politics?
Yeah, I think that's a very natural question to ask, that if an individual is taking risky and self-destructive acts in his or her private life, is that an indicator of the danger that that person would put the country in? And psychologists actually have been studying this question for at least 60 years with lots of careful looks and lots of debate. And what we've found actually remarkably is it's tempting to think that we can describe each other with very broad personality traits, like he's smart or she's outgoing or he's fearful. And what we've learned is that that's not right, that even with regard to intelligence, there is not one attribute of each of us that describes our intelligence. We have lots of intelligences. We're maybe good at reading maps and not so good at doing math. And similarly, it turns out that behaviors like risk-taking are very situation-specific. A person who might smoke cigarettes and take risks with his or her health is not necessarily at all a risk-taker when driving or when running the country. And so it's very tempting to say, this guy's nuts. He's done self-destructive things repeatedly, addictively. How can we trust him with the country? And I'm afraid that, you know, that the psychological research wouldn't support the idea that that's diagnostic of that person's political behavior.
Yeah, but what the alternative, though, is, I think, in many ways, is also alarming, the idea that the only people that you should have running politics are members of the Mormon Tabernacle Choir. I mean, just completely pious and prudish people who haven't had a lot of life experience and sort of eunuchs. I mean, that seems to me to be almost worse.
Yeah, there is certainly that risk. Now, I will acknowledge that as a person who has a second career as a musician, I kind of like your image of the Mormon Tabernacle Choir being in charge. But the idea that our standards would be such that the conservative morality that is, as you know, we've heard so correctly, it is widely endorsed in the country, becomes a requirement. In fact, I'm not sure it is a requirement in the electoral process. In fact, we don't see that at all in the electoral process. But it does become a lever to unseat politicians when the press get a hold of a scandal and can put the spotlight on and say to Americans, really? You want this person in elected office?
Pepper Schwartz, again, professor of sociology and sexology at the University of Washington in Seattle. Tell me, what's your response to the idea that maybe the choices between piety and this kind of behavior, that maybe that you could have somebody that's too pious, too proper, hasn't had enough life experience? What's your response to that?
Well, I think that's the history of the United States. We've had a lot of people who mouthed to that. Those pieties, and you know, and that's where we get our scandals from. But I think that that's a dichotomization that's not necessary. I mean, increasingly, because of the baby boom and all the people who followed it, we're going to have people with paths, and I think people are willing to accept.
Is that your phone, Pepper? Yeah, let's see if we can call Pepper back maybe, because the phone's is quite unpleasant. Dr. John Krosnick, again, the director of Stanford University's Political Psychology Program. We have a situation where you've got a Congress now that is, I think, historically down to about 8% approval. And frankly, I wonder who that 8% are, but it couldn't be worse. And we're talking about a couple of very prominent liberal Democrats who are in trouble, Wiener, who had to leave the Congress, and Bob Filner, who quit to become mayor of San Diego and is now in trouble. And I mentioned all the other ones as well earlier who've had some political redemption. But the long and the short of it is that it seems to me that the question is, you know, why is it that you have this universal contempt for politicians at the same time they have more tenure than academics do? I mean, there's less turnover in the United States Congress than there was in the Supreme Soviet of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union.
Yes, well, it's certainly true that the American public's approval of Congress is at an all-time low. And it's also true that incumbents who are in the Congress have a remarkably high probability of being reelected. And that's apparently a dilemma on the surface. If we are unhappy with Congress, why don't we throw them out? The challenge is that we can each only vote out one person. And yet what research shows is that people are not unhappy with their representative. They're unhappy with the system, with the collective in Washington, where at this point it's extremely predictable. The Democrats in Congress only vote for bills put up by Democrats, and the Republicans in Congress only vote for bills put up by Republicans. It didn't used to be this way. There used to be cooperation and collaboration decades ago. That's disappeared now, and it's caused this gridlock. In fact, you may know that the leader of one of the political parties in Washington in the Congress has pronounced that he will allow nothing to get passed during the Obama administration. And so I think that's the sentiment that has Americans beside themselves with frustration. But the solution is not vote their own congressional representative out, particularly if they like that person's politics and approach to what's going on. And it would certainly be understandable not to hold that person responsible for the dysfunction of the collective. So the real question is, you know, what's causing it? And many people who are doing research into this are pointing increasingly to the campaign finance situation, that essentially that once incumbents are in office, the fundraising efforts reinforce exactly what's happening, which is sort of among people as well as
No, I just wanted to get a quick word from Pepper Schwartz here, who we lost there for a moment. Just in terms of getting the politics we deserve and the politicians we deserve, Congress has an all-time low approval of 8%, which again seems even high to me. But here we have the paradox: you got universal contempt for the Congress, yet we keep reelecting these people. Go figure.
Well, you know, the problem is each person is elected by a relatively narrow band of people. And they're responsible, particularly in Congress, to that narrow band of people. So they'll get reelected till the cows come home if their constituency is ideologically extreme, so that they're less interested in movement and more interested in representation of that ideology. I mean, sometimes I think we get who we deserve, and that frightens me, of course.
Well, tell me about that just in the last minute then. Why is it that – is it the fact that there are only 90% of our politicians are women, that this is more of a problem with men? Or do you think women, if they get more of them in politics, will have an equal number of scandals?
No, I don't think we'll have equal numbers of scandals. For one thing, the paraphilias, like the thing that Wiener's doing where he needs to expose himself for his sexual thrills. Well, those things are about 97% male. We don't really understand why they're so extremely male. I mean, it's very rare for women to have some of this more bizarre behavior, having an affair, having a lover. There's the younger statistics on younger people seem to indicate that women will be doing more of that now that, you know, they've had this socialization of hooking up and stuff. But I think the things that are at this level of impulsiveness will not be done as much by women, both because they don't have the same kind of sexual kinks, they just don't, and secondly, because they have children and they seem to be more mindful of the consequences to those children than the men do. You know, does that make them better politicians? No, I suppose it makes them less interesting reading. But I think that that having women in office will make it both duller, and maybe we can concentrate a little bit more on what they do or do not.
Well, I welcome the dullness, and I thank both of you for joining us here, Dr. John Krosnick, Director of the Stanford University Political Psychology Program, and Pepper Schwartz, a Professor of Sociology and Sexology at the University of Washington in Seattle. Thank you both.
My pleasure.
This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producers Claire Goldsmith and Nick Garino. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.
Singing something to me, an angel song about the home of the brave and the land here.